You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kourula. Happy New Year. We're going to start the year off right. We have a very special guest tonight, living legend, guitarist for Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Lauryn Hill, Ben Harper, the list goes on, Steven Seagal, Mr. Al Anderson. How are you, Al?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Nikki?
You look very chill and your room looks very cool. What are the masks above you, out of curiosity?
This is the Raven Stealing the Sun by some West Coast artist up in Canada made this for me, a family.
It looks like it's Vancouver. That's what the tribes look like, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
My dad had a bunch of that artwork from tribes in Vancouver and the Western Canadian region. So I was like, that looks familiar, but it looks awesome. I like that you also have reggae colors a little bit. You got some gold. How many gold records and platinum records do you have up?
A whole bunch of them, but I don't have any money to back them up.
That's all right. You are a living legend. You are quite the guitarist and musical presence. We're going to go back to the days when you first started playing guitar. What was the moment of zen that made you want to pick up the guitar? Was it family playing records for you? Was it a song that you heard on the radio? What was the moment that made you want to be a guitarist?
I saw Chuck Berry and the Beach Boys and Elvis on Ed Sullivan. And people were screaming and clapping. And I said, wow, this is pretty cool. That'd be an interesting job to have. Because I saw it as like pretty much... It wasn't for fun. These guys were getting paid for their talent. So, yeah. And Hee-Haw. I was an avid Hee-Haw participant who would watch Roy Clark and Vince Gill at a very early age peeling, you know. So,
that's awesome. What was your first guitar? Do you remember the first guitar that you bought?
First guitar I bought was at Manny's Music. It was a 64-65 Butterscotch Telecaster.
God!
With a maple neck and a Bigsby vibrato. And he gave it to me in a box. It didn't even have a case. So I took that on the 66 home, and that was the start.
And do you still have that guitar?
I wish I did.
I did too, because that sounds like a beast of a guitar to play, and what a cherry instrument. I know, you know, it's like, it's funny when people buy guitars, especially like back in the day in the 60s and 70s, there are so many people swapping guitars and selling them other gear that they wanted. Did you sell that for another instrument that you had your eyes on that you really wanted more?
Yeah, the thing, Bigsby's don't stay in tune that well, you know, and I like, it was pitchy, and I like a guitar that's tight, that keeps its tune. So it had to go and find another one. And then I graduated to Les Pauls and Stratocasters after that, Tele. But I have one in the corner over here. But it's a Parts Caster. And it reminds me of the one I used to have.
That's awesome. And, I'm going to ask you a guitar nerd question. What gauge strings do you use? Because whenever I hear, like, your solos, you always have this monstrous tone. So I assume you probably play like 12s, maybe 11s.
No way.
Really? No way.
Nines. I used to use 10s, but it started to fatigue my hands. So I went to the Dario, and I love Ernie Balls, but they don't last long, you know. So I went to the Dario NYs, and 9 through 42 seems to be my favorite now. because I don't have to work as hard.
I love the DRs. I was like looking through so many strings and I just landed on DRs and I just love the way they feel. And I don't know if I'll move. I used to love pyramids, but man, I went through so many different string phases, but now I'm just like
Yeah, I used to
love.
use a D'Acousto and Fenders and Gibson, the classic old ones back in the day, but you try to find strings have come a long way
Right.
from
Now,
like the.
ask you a guitar question. What is your favorite or your go-to guitar whenever you're tracking or when you want to perform? What is the first guitar that you think of that is your go-to?
Now, it used to be a Strat back in the 70s, 80s. I did a lot of tours with Bob with a Strat.
Those
I had a in old the first tour I did with him, I had a 57 blonde Strat, and I graduated to buying a Les Paul from Richie Friedman. I bought a 60 Les Paul
Wow.
burst, for he said, Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, I've got his eyes on this guitar. If you come here next week at 3 o'clock and give me $3,000, it's yours. So I had to work real hard and I got the money up and I went and bought a 60 burst from Richie Friedman at We Buy on 48th Street, right
Wow.
across the street where I bought my Telecaster at Manny's, my 65, 64 Tele, I think it was
Do you
around that time.
still have that 57 Strat that you said you had?
No, I sold it to a producer over in Jimmy Haynes, who
Wow.
produces he produces Oswald. Well, he a big producer. He loved it, and so the I needed something that was a little bit more modern and had a little more output pickup wise,
Right.
because I played Naughty Dread with that guitar.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, the Naughty Dread album I played with. A 57 Strat, Maple,
Now,
not Strat.
before we get into the Bob Marley music, did you ever start a band in high school or play with like neighborhood kids? Did you ever start a band like that?
Oh yeah, I used to deliver newspapers and I used to sell like Christmas cards for Marvel magazine to get like I got my first bugle when I was around 15 or something like that, and I learned taps.
Wow.
And charge and all that stuff.
And you put, I saw you
And
played a little trombone too, is that right?
I graduated to trombone. A friend of mine's mother, who lived across the street, she worked for a music program in the town where she said that the state were giving free musical lessons and free instruments. But the only thing that was left, by the time I got to the program was a trombone, so I liked it. Trombone was nice, but it's a lot of positions and it's really spitty and stuff. So,
Yeah, it's not a sexy instrument. It's really hard to make the trombone like look and feel sexy because it's kind of.
it sounds great, though.
I love it.
I love Chicago, and
Yeah, me. I wanted to ask you too. You went to Berklee College of Music.
no, I didn't. I
Well,
didn't.
that in your Wikipedia. It said you went to Berklee with Al DiMeola.
My Wikipedia has the wrong age, and
Okay.
I've been fighting with them to get them to change it to social media wise, and they just want to keep it the way it is. The only I went to Berkeley used to have rehearsal rooms. There was teachers like Mick Goodrick.
Yep.
And a lot of big name Al DiMeola guitars were doing seminars, and Pat Metheny and Benson would come up, and
Wow.
Pat Martino, John McLaughlin. And so I would sneak into the classes because when Berklee started, a friend of mine named a great guitarist named Ed Rogers and a really great drummer named Chuck Berge, who plays with Billy Joel these days, they went to Berklee. And so I went from New York up into Boston and just decided that I was going to get a job and sneak into the Berklee courses as long as I possibly could. So I got like 5, 6, 7 months out of it. And as soon as they developed the identification passes, yeah, that was the pass to get into the class. I didn't have that. So after a bunch of months of getting free education and using all the facilities there, I never paid tuition. My friends did. They were going to school there. But I would sneak into all the courses and study with Mick Goodrick and Major Holly and stuff. And then Herbie Hancock would come and do seminars. And I went to all the seminars there. And I really did learn a lot for free. But I never went to Berkeley. It's all wrong. Wikipedia is somebody did that. I don't know. It's like some strange person decided there was no Wikipedia on me, so they made one of what they knew of me, and it was all the wrong information. So we're trying to scratch that out and get a new one up,
Well, we're
get the
documenting
real.
it here right now. But you know what? You could also be the smartest Berkeley students that went to the school without having to pay tuition. So you made some smart decisions. What were some of the coolest things you learned at that time as you were growing as a musician?
Ear training, substitutions, chord, multiple chord concepts. Mick Goodrick is a fantastic teacher. He taught a lot of great guitars, and John Scofield would come through. Just an incredible talent. With a lot of high level masters would come through, and every time we heard, like every week, somebody was coming as another master was leaving from teaching a seminar. We would always be there. I wasn't the only one sneaking in because, there was no registration. It was just like you paid your tuition, and we're going to get these IDs eventually. And it just took months for them to get like an identification card, a Berkeley identification card that proved that you were a tuition student. You paid to go to the school, and but I never was a Berkeley student. I snuck in, and I got free education.
Were you kind of gravitating towards jazz and blues and rock, or were you kind of just like into art?
Everything, everything, everything that was on the plate. We would dissect it, and I love folk music, Sylvain Luc, and all the great Segovia, Paco de Lucía, and these great guitars. Learned a little bit from everybody I could possibly learn something from.
That's awesome. Well, that definitely explains your playing style too. I can hear that you gravitate towards so many different styles when you're playing solos, and you're always playing something different. Let's go into this Bob Marley legacy. Tell me how you kind of got linked to Bob Marley and how that whole thing started.
I didn't know anything about reggae music to say, but when I got to England, where there was a lot more Jamaicans than I was aware of in New York City and Jersey, there was a friend of mine. I met Traffic and Free and all the guys in Traffic, and Maynard Ferguson had a jazz group. And Bud Parks and Woody and Paul Kossoff, lead guitarist of Free, said, "Hey, why don't you come over to London? Because there's a lot of studios." And I basically left New York City to do an album with Woody. Woody was doing a solo project, Chris Wood, the saxophone player, and ended up living with Bud Parks and his family. And he was one of the first trumpet players for Maynard Ferguson, and hung out with Mitch Mitchell and Woody. Woody had a lot of friends, and Dave Mason and Jim Capaldi. They were really nice people to me, and Bud Parks and Goo, and yeah,
All the cats.
there was a lot of studio horn players that, I was renting a room in Raines Park, and I used to go in town to London on the tram and hang out with Woody, and Woody and Paul were really good friends. And so I became really good friends with Paul Kossoff. He had an Abbott amplifier collection and a string of guitars from 50s to 70s.
Wow.
And a lot of amplifiers. I wasn't so familiar with Marshalls. I knew about the Fenders, but he introduced me to the Orange and Hi-Watt in the Marshall family of amplifiers.
Is that what you
And
got your go-to amp? You use a Marshall?
Fender and Marshalls are still pretty much of my repertoire, yeah.
I've
But it
got
was
a Vibraverb. I just want a
oh,
Vibraverb.
great, great stuff.
It's the only amp I want to buy next, and I'm just going to wait until I absolutely can pull the trigger on it. But I usually use a Twin and a Deluxe, but
Oh man, yeah.
those are
One
two
of
of
my favorite. My
my.
favorite.
Twin, or you use a Deluxe, or you and a Marshall? Is that what you said? You said Fender
Yeah,
and.
between the three of them, you know, that if I'm in a studio, that's the ones that I would pick to play. I think on my solo project, I used a 50-watt small box 50 through 2x12 Orange amp.
Wow.
And it was a new one and it sounded really nice.
Those break up so nice too. They've got
Yeah, and the clean sound was good too.
right. That's amazing. So you were you playing with Traffic or just hanging with those guys for a little
I
bit?
toured with them, you know. And so that, you know, at Island, you know, there was just a whole bunch of people there, John Martin, and which you're familiar with, and Nico and Eno and Roxy Music, and Jimmy Cliff was there, and you
Amazing.
know. Just a lot of really nice people. And I was a tape op at Island, but before Island, I was working with Richard Branson and Delroy Washington and Oswalt, the early Oswalt members. And I got to England, as I said, and I befriended Paul Kossoff because when they were touring with Traffic, it was Traffic and Free. And
Right.
then when I got in England, that's when I toured with Traffic with a group with Remy Kabaka called Shakatu, with Don Kimona and Lofty Amayo. No, actually, Lofty wasn't in that band. That was Smiley and Don Kimona. And I got to know Paul and, you know, we'd hang out and have a smoke and have a few jars. And he had beautiful guitars. We would play all day and night. So one night I was over at his house late, and Chris Blackwell from Island Records called Paul to come in, and Bob Marley was in London at the time doing a solo album, the Naughty Dread album, which they recorded in Jamaica, and brought the album over, brought the master over to overdub at Basin Street Studios in London. And Paul wasn't in condition to do the session. So he gave me the opportunity to sub for him. And that's how I got back with Chris. And Chris introduced me to Bob.
That must have been an intimidating room to walk into. You said you were, I think we talked earlier, and you said you may have been around 19 or 20 years old. Is that around the time?
Yeah, like that. Yeah. But
Crazy.
it wasn't intimidating. I didn't know anybody. So it was just like, oh, here's a session. And you know, I just remember not seeing anyone with hair like Bob. Bob had a lot of hair. And then there's Chris Blackwell. He had long hair as well. And I walked straight in the studio from the minicab with a wah-wah in my Strat. I plugged into a twin reverb and I just told the engineer, let me hear what you have.
And you just wanted to like paint like soundscape or like play around what was there.
Yeah, I kind of, Paul played Catch a Fire and Burn It for me. And I got to hear Wayne Perkins, Bobby Womack's guitar player, as we said. And he played slide and stuff. And I, you know, I learned slide from Duane Allman, and Johnny Winter taught me how to play slide.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it is really crazy. I learned on a garbage can backstage at the Fillmore East for a couple joints, you know.
That is wild. That's wild.
Yeah. And so I heard the music and I was like, wow. I had never heard anything that laid back and in the pocket. So they said, are you ready? And I said, yeah, let it rip. So we started out with Soja. I say, I played that once. Roadblock, I played once, twice. No Woman, No Cry, once, twice. And then Talking Blues, I played her. Acoustic guitar on that, and
Oh my.
all the stuff that I had done on Not to Dread, and it was really a quick session, you know, because I in the beginning I couldn't relate to anything, but after I had heard, it took like some minutes to hear the track
Right.
and to figure out how I would saturate it and produce my guitar sound for what I was hearing for, the artist. And yeah, it was like about 35, 45 minutes.
And just
And
add any effects to you or to your sound, or you just wanted to make all those changes to the sound with just the wah?
yeah, I really like the wah-wah thing, because a lot of artists that if I play straight without any effects or pedals, it's loud and they don't like it. And the wah kind of quiets that loud sound. It kind of like shields.
Almost squashes it a little bit, almost like a.
Yeah, it kind of compresses a little bit so it's not so in your face. And I did a lot of wah work with Bob, and I used wah on So Jah Say. And that was one of my favorite tracks. And after I had finished everything, I went into the control booth and there was Bob. And Chris had introduced me to Bob at that time. And I kind of rekindled my friendship with Chris Blackwell, because from hanging out with Traffic and Free in New York, we would stay at his, I think he had a hotel called the Essex House. I'm not really sure whether he had owned it at that time, but I think he was one of the owners of the hotel. But, I became friends with Traffic and Free, and that's what brought me to pretty much to England to work with Virgin first, and graduate over to Island
And
and get that opportunity to play on the Not to Dread album.
you said it was cool. We talked earlier, and you said when you walked in and you were in the control room, they played you So Just Say, you were like completely blown away with how big the sound was and how everything was just feeling so good. Was that correct?
It was a Maestro drum machine. There was no drummer. So I was like, okay, wow, this is kind of hip. Because I think the only thing that I could relate to was Sexual Healing
Right.
from Marvin. And Bob and Marvin were good friends.
So crazy.
And I don't know how Sexual Healing had it and then Bob had it on his, maybe they talked about it was a cool piece, but Bob ended up using one and recorded the drum sound for it, and playing to it was a nice pocket. It was a really groovy.
Well, let's play the track. Here's Bob Marley. So killing pocket, your groove and on the wah is just insane, man. You're just painting all over that song. It's so beautiful.
Well, thank you, man. I
I wanted
appreciate
to ask
that.
if you remember your pickup position when you were playing on the wah for that. Do you remember it?
That was a neck pickup.
Okay. It sounds
Yeah.
really, 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 really great and incredibly warm. Do you remember the tape they used that they were recording on by chance?
Ampex.
Okay. All right. I've recorded on analog tape a couple times, and I've used Scotch 250. That seems to be my favorite. But I'm always amazed with Bob Marley and Jimi Hendrix recordings because the tape just sounds incredible. And I'm always just curious because it just sounds so warm. So when you were playing that, did you think it was going to be as big of a record as you did, or did you just think it was just another session?
The first thing I realize is that there's been few times that a guitar player would, Bob is playing the other lead guitar on a Gibson, like single cut special. And so he's playing all these riffs, and I'm playing to him, like with him. Like he's doing his part, dun, 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 the descending parts, and I'm playing the ascending leads. And I thought that was really cool. And I knew that No Woman, No Cry was going to be a chart topper because it just it hits your heart, you know,
Yes.
the whole song. But yeah, So Just Say for me was a very spiritual sounding song that it made you think of what he was thinking when he wrote the song, you know. So he was probably in a really celestial place where he was most of the time, and it came out of him, and it was a joy to be able to join him playing lead guitar on that track.
Well, it's such a cool dialogue in the guitar parts too. It's like
It's pretty cool.
what makes it drives the song and the groove, and then you have the like the horns almost act like backup singers with their parts, you know?
Oh
So
man, that's Tommy McCook. He's smoking, man. He was great.
this whole record is one of Bob's best. And I mean, it's got Lively Up Yourself, it's got No Woman, No Cry, So Just Say. I mean, just one of the iconic records. It's always crazy to me when people tell me, yeah, we did one or two takes and that was it. It's almost like it's best to just not think about it, not overthink, and just move on. But you are composing on the fly, like in the moment, which is tremendously hard to do when everything's already set. And if you're doing one take, you know, you have to have a tremendous amount of restraint. So tell me where that place comes from for you, like playing for the music and just knowing when not to play as important as when to play.
When you have the record CEO and the artist staring at you, like directly at you, you know, like what do you have? What, you know, what can you produce right now? And that can be intimidating. But for me, actually, it was like I was just more into the headphones. What was filling my mind with sound? And I just followed through to my best ability to, because I thought it sounded really good.
Oh, it did.
Like
Does.
the,
Still
you
does.
know, they had rough mixes at that time, and those rough mixes really, the bass and the drummer, Carly and Family Man, they were right there, you know,
Right.
and they played a lot of the rhythm parts and the guitar part and his vocals, and so I could play around the vocals and kind of just add my parts to the master that had already been created, you know. So just put a little color, my little color in there, and it came out really nicely.
You also played on Survival, which is my favorite Bob Marley record, front to back, and Uprising. I wanted to ask you about Babylon System when you were recording, just Survival in general. What was the experience like? What were some of the coolest moments you had recording with Bob on that record?
We had a really good engineer that Chris suggested to help produce because he wanted to really bring the recording up to a really high standard. And it was Alex Satkin who had done I Want to Know What Love Is. And he engineered Jocko's first album,
Wow.
his first solo album. And him. Alex Satkin and Jack Newber were great, a great team, and they both were engineering at Island. So it was a real joy to have where you could hear everything,
Right.
and he would listen to us, and not like overproduce it on his behalf, like because he didn't know he was in the same position I was in. Like when I went to London. Went to Basin Street Studio, met Bob Marley. He met us. He met Bob. He came in with his strength and intelligence and just added it to all the sounds of the musicians that were around Bob. And he did a great job. Alex, he spent a lot of time on keypexing and cleaning up tracks. He would have tape and he would just run it. And if there was any bleeding, he tried to balance out everything. He spent a lot of time on survival. So that's why when you hear survival, you hear a really good sounding album if you compare them to Soul Rebels, Catch a Fire, Burning. There was a lot of bleeding going on, but I love that. But survival was a special edition of mixing and engineering and production on that record.
About that record, it's something I always reference all the time when I'm writing or when I'm in a studio. It's there's something that just has the perfect balance of sound, balance, mix, songs, guitar parts, the bass, the EQ, all of it. It's just a absolutely brilliant record. It's my favorite, and Babylon System is actually my favorite Bob Marley song.
Wow.
I love So Much Trouble in the World. I love Top Ranking. I mean, these are just incredible songs. Did you guys know when you were in the studio working on this record, did you know you were on to something, or was it just like it was just working on just making it as good as it could be and move forward?
Well, it wasn't one of those on the fly records. We rehearsed. We would go to the back rehearsal room and back of Tuff Gong and spend a lot of time in. A family man had a four-track tape there, which we would do a lot of recording and just sit around and have a smoke and listen to everything we were doing. And when it came time to go in the studio and do the master of the recording, we knew exactly what we should do because we had pre-produced all the parts, and then it just became like freestyling.
I love that you're saying that because that's what I do when I record a record. I usually rehearse my band for about 6 months, and then we go in the studio and we just lay everything down because we've arranged everything. So I love it. Made my day actually, because it's kind of cool when you hear how people approach pre-production. And I wanted to move on because you not only played with one reggae legend, you played with two, Peter Tosh. I mean, you played with many, but I mean, two of the biggest, you probably, those are probably one and two as far as the biggest reggae artists out there. Peter Tosh, tell me what that was like recording and working with him.
Well, the first record was like, legalize it was like playing with Bob because it was Carly and Family Man,
Right.
on the record and Wire. So that was really hip. And then we got to Equal Rights. And then here comes Robbie and Sly that at that time they were on fire, man. As a production team, as a bass and drum,
Right.
ensemble, they were unstoppable. And Peter's songwriting was getting better after, Equal Rights, but he had a car crash and it kind of slowed down things. And he got really slumber and kind of methodical about what he was going to write and say, methodical. And he came up with all these songs like Apartheid, Step and Razor, and it was a joy. It was really different because they're between working with Bob and Peter, they're just completely two different
Right. Of
territories,
course.
and same state of mind. I played with Bunny live. I never
Wow.
Chynna Earl Chynna Smith, the one of the greatest Jamaican session players. Everybody loved him because you don't have to tell him anything. He just goes in, he aces it, first track next. And these guys, Robbie and Sly, Carly and Family Man, Chynna, and all the guys on the Tyrone and Wire, they were doing like two or three albums a day. They
Wow.
went from studio to st it was like at that time when I was in Jamaica, it was like reggae Nashville.
Right.
Studios everywhere, musicians hanging out, and then there was Tuff Gong and Idler's Rest, and Tommy Cohen had a nice little spot. And then just everything started building up. Third World bought Zinc Fence. Then Ricky's got Nixon Lab and stuff. So things started to evolve, and we had opportunity. I had that opportunity to work with Peter and do the same thing for him that I did for Bob.
That's, I mean, you know what? I have to tell you, you're a reggae treasure just because you've done that. You were kind of another voice that was supporting two biggest reggae artists of all time. And I really feel like Peter Tosh's record, Legalize It, and Steppin' Razor too. It's like some of those fiery songs that Peter Tosh wrote. Did he ever kind of talk about like what his message or his legacy was starting to become at that time, or was he just, pissed off with the world and ready to fight for people's rights and spread a message of revolution?
It was a lot of everything. He was fire, man. He had a lot to say. He was very opinionated, and it caused a lot of trouble for him. He was the first marijuana activist, and one of the first in Jamaica who really supported to legalization of, because if you're going to dedicate your album to legalization of marijuana, you
Right.
can imagine how deeply he was involved in smoking and loving the fact that what marijuana does for the mind, for him. And yeah, Peter was amazing. He was just a very outspoken. He suffered the consequences on smoking publicly. I was with him down at Aquarius Studios, Herman Chinloy's place, and he had a big spliff, and a police officer was insulted by him because he thought he was disrespecting, the law. And so he came up and assaulted him with a baton
Wow.
for weed.
That's
He
crazy.
just We had to take him to the hospital. He got several stitches. I think like 30, 40 stitches or something like this. They almost killed him for a draw of weed. And that's why he was so involved in the legalization of marijuana. And then I had a lot of respect for him because the police officer smashed him right in front of me. And then I went like, wow, Jamaica's really a tough place where, the musicians like him should, they should have a little bit of rights,
Right.
but they jailed all of us. I went to jail for marijuana down there, and tough place.
Well, let's play Steppin' Razor, because I want people to hear what you played on it, and I've got some questions about it. So here's Steppin' Razor by Peter Tosh. So much ear candy in that song, man. So good. I got a couple guitar questions. What are you doing with the distortion? Are you using amp? Are you using the amp? Are you using a pedal for that distortion at the top?
That was
Sound like a fuzz, but I don't know if it was a fuzz.
no, it was a Gibson Skylark through a Les Paul Junior.
Wow. So you're just the dirt of the amp?
Straight from the amp.
Wow. It's a killer sound on that. Just a killer sound on that.
That's all that was there. It was really in bad shape.
And it sound amazing because it's
Yeah,
so.
it came out pretty cool. And Bunny's on that singing the background
Yeah,
vocals as well.
it's so cool too because Bob, Bunny, and Peter started as the Wailers together, and just to see like their musical evolution was so deep. I mean, it was just so deep. Like what they created, what they released for people to enjoy, still to enjoy, and when you're playing all over that song, and it's just textural. I hear the wah stuff you're doing, but I love the dirty stuff you're doing.
No, I'm only playing the solo. That's Carl Peterson playing the rhythm part.
Okay, cool.
That's Carl, and Peter Skang, and
Well, the film is amazing, though.
it's a diss track to me.
Explain that.
He had a really bad manager. Herbie was good, was cool, but he got some guy from Trinidad who was taking advantage of Robbie and Sly and us and wasn't paying us on time and stuff. And it was going back into that same thing of bad business, and
Right.
I decided to walk away from the band. And so he really got angry. And because he goes, oh, Al Anderson put him out where him jaw there and thinks, say, he's going to chuck through the earth. And bluntly, you haven't gone through 1/5 the tribulation as me. So he was saying that about me. And that's good, because that's how he felt. And I felt the same way. You know, I didn't come to Jamaica for anything other than to be a servant to the music.
Right.
And I, there was a lot of cats who wanted to be stars. And they wanted to star it and stand out. And I always found myself on the backside with Tyrone, just like me and Tyrone on one side, playing all the music we could play. It was the same with Wire. Wire was in Peter's group. We just stayed away from all the attention.
Right.
And because some guys, you know, they're starstruck by being in the video and on camera. So that's not me. I just, you know, really wanted to help the music. Get reggae music, get Jamaican music on American Bandstand, get it on American wavelength, you know, the sound of their music on radio in America. And we achieved our agenda.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Now let's fast forward a little bit, because I want to definitely play this track. You got this amazing opportunity to work with Lauryn Hill on Miseducation. And yeah. It's such an iconic record, too. You're now on another iconic record. How did you kind of come into that fold? And what was the kind of situation that you were in those sessions?
I was working with Loris Holland, and Lauren had some incredible tracks, you know, that weren't finished. So we spent a long time, like hours. You know, I slept on a sofa there and just had Chinese food for days. But you know, you're so caught up in the music, nothing mattered.
Right.
And so I got a chance to play on that track, Nothing Matters at All. And I think
and D'Angelo's on it, rest in peace. Playing on a track that's
super cat.
D'Angelo and Lauryn Hill were both recording. Did you get to meet D'Angelo?
I did.
Wow.
Emmanuel Luiz is playing upright bass on that too.
Wow.
Bad cat, man. They're surrounded by monster musicians. That particular track. Huh?
And I know John, I think John Legend was in the band on a couple tracks too.
Not during while I was working with her. That's probably before me, when he was working with Jahari.
Yes.
And Kino and the Jahari brothers.
Well, let's play that track. Let's play Lauryn Hill. Here's Lauryn Hill and D'Angelo with Nothing Ever Matters.
Yeah, that's a Strat.
Man, and what was the amp? Do you remember?
Twin.
Dude, you got just a sound when you... Just that simple. That's what's meat and potatoes right there. Like, man, it sounds so good. And you played all the right things in all the right places. What was that session like for you?
D'Angelo is incredible. Lauryn is... she works really hard, man. She's like one of the hardest working women in show business at that time, you know, when she was doing this record. She put her heart and soul into everything. And, you know, D'Angelo can improvise so well. I mean, he can sing any harmony and play any harmony part on piano accompany himself. Like what I love about him, how he improvises and accompanies his vocal range. And, you know, his band is incredible. And I've seen him on sessions too. You know, he's done a lot of stuff with Roots and stuff. And, man, he's a heck of a talent, both of them. You know, like, genuinely incredible to work with.
Well, you're an incredible talent yourself, and it is no coincidence that you worked with Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Ben Harper, Lauryn Hill, a slew of others, Steven Seagal, the Karate Man himself. Are there any moments for you, either live or in the studio, that were like pinch me moments for you as a musician?
I don't really consider myself to be where I'm wrapped around me. It's all about the artist. I'm a servant.
Right.
I serve. I don't mind carrying the cross at all, It's just the weight of, you don't want to let anybody down. Or do the wrong thing, or because a lot of stuff is you hear it and you don't like it. I've done some things where I wasn't so happy about how they were mixed, but I was satisfied with in which what I played on the track. And like I said, I'm in music for the love of music and for the love of the artist, and loving the fact that it's going to come out. And if it gets on the radio, that's even more. I've done a lot of recordings where what I have played, I've heard on the radio around the world. And that's very pleasing.
Yeah, it has to.
Pinch me moments, not so. I think Lyceum was pretty heavy, though. I gotta admit, that was like, wow. I had such a hard time getting myself on stage. We had done a sound check at the Lyceum, and basically it was a live version with the whole band and the I-Trees and of Naughty Dread.
Right.
So I had like 20-minute window before we were going to go on stage, and we didn't know it was going to be a live recording.
Wow.
Nobody told us that, okay, this is going to be a live recording and get ready to be recorded, and here's the contract, here's your rights.
Right.
So my gear fell apart, because I had gone on stage to check all my stuff. So none of my stuff worked. And Third World had opened up for the Wailers on that tour. So I know Cat Core had this little phaser and he was on his bus. So I ran out to the bus looking for him, found him. He gave me his pedal. And on the way back into the Lyceum, I saw this stu mobile studio. And it said Rolling Stones Mobile Studio. I said, holy fuck, we're being recorded. Because I saw scaffolding and stuff, but I thought it was for video, just for
Right.
promotion. I thought it was going to be for promotion. We thought everything was going to be for promotion, but it was an illegal recording on the artists that were, part. I don't know whether Bob knew or he had to know. I believe he did know. But I had to find out, I only had a 20-minute window to get that pedal and get back on stage because none of my stuff worked. So I walked by the mobile studio, which was owned by the Rolling Stones, and they rented out too. And so I open the door, and there's Steve Smith and Chris Blackwell behind this massive board with a monitor. And I'm like, yo, what's happening? And they go like, oh, aren't you supposed to be on stage? And I had like probably 10, 5 minutes to get back in there. And so I'm speaking with Chris, telling him that nobody knows that, you're recording this. And why would you do something like this? And so he said, you better get back in there and, and do your thing.
Wow.
So it was a really strange occurrence that, you find out that now you are being recorded. And so I got really sensitive to the fact that it's like, hey, you can't make any mistakes in a live recording. You know what I mean?
Right.
It would be easy for them to erase the track and you could overdo it or overdub it as it's done. But it's better when you capture everything at that moment, on the moment, at that time. So everything came out really good. But
Most
we
I
never knew. We never knew we were being recorded, and we didn't get compensated for the live recording as well
That's
as a
whack.
band. which was really strange.
Well, you made live arts, studio arts, and iconic records throughout your career, and I hope I get the chance to work with you, Al, because you really are a treasure for music, a treasure for humanity. And I could do a 5-hour interview with you, but we're gonna have to cut it short this time. But I'm gonna have you back. We're gonna talk more about your life and music because you are an exceptional human being and an amazing musician. So thanks for being on Wake Up Hollywood. I really appreciate your time.
Well, I honestly thank you for your kind words,
I mean them.
and all the best and blessings to you in this year of the horse. And we're gonna ride into the sunshine and spread music throughout the world and cause everything to be peaceful with music and love
Love
for
that.
me, for
That
music.
Happy New Year. That was a perfect way to end this show. On behalf of Al, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, and take care of yourselves.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Korula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.